I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Tom McGuire. He's a musician, a conductor, arts administrator. He's a great lover and supporter of dance, particularly ballet. And tomorrow, Tuesday, the 22nd of November, he's giving a talk at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore called Barbarians at the Gate, Stravinsky, Diaghilev, and the Ballet Russe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So let's talk about this period in the history of art in Europe and Russia in particular. Diaghilev came up right around the time, in the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, and the arts at that time were in a tremendous and fascinating moment of flowering. What was it like in Diaghilev's time and when he was coming into his career?
Well, when he first came to the West, he actually came with visual arts because his first programs in Paris were visual arts. He did the Salon for the Autumn Salon in 1909, and he brought visual artists to that salon. He also then, the next thing he brought from Mother Russia was opera. He brought Boris Godunov. So he came up through the Imperial Theaters in St. Petersburg before the revolution. And in doing so, he was, I don't want to call him a dilettante because he was much beyond that. His training was to be in public service, but he had a great love of music, and particularly music, and visual arts, and ballet. And so he brought those in this order. He brought first visual arts, and these were outrageous works that people had never seen from the steppes of Central Asia and from Mother Russia in general, and brought that, and then opera, and then he brought ballet. And he found his great success with ballet, and I think he was, an early version of what we now call an entrepreneur. And immediately he saw the value of doing more of that work. And so after the season with Boris and opera, he never went back really to opera. He produced ballet, and that became known as the Ballet Russe. At the beginning, it was just a Russian season of ballet. But it was at that time, as you say, that he was riding the crest of all of the changes. I mean, if you think about the fact that he brought together people like Picasso to do sets and costumes for something like Parade, when Picasso was fully, in the full-blown section of that Cubist period of his work, he brought that to Parade. He brought people like Satie as a composer. He brought Debussy and Ravel. He brought Matisse. He brought all of these, Manuel de Falla. He brought all of those people together. And I think his brilliance was being able to collaborate with all of these people, sometimes with a very, strong iron fist. But he was able to bring these brilliant works to life in that period of time.
Now, how much of his great work, and indeed the Ballet Russe, happened in Russia, if any?
None.
None.
Because when he came from Russia, he brought, ballet in the West had been in total decline. And the best work was being done in Russia, mostly by Marius Petipa, the great choreographer, and the composers there, everybody from Borodin to Tchaikovsky were doing ballet. But when they brought the first pieces in the first season, they were actually very, today we would look at them as very, very old-fashioned, but they weren't, in that period of time, they weren't considered old-fashioned. They were shocking because they weren't stylized ballet, but they brought Russian technique to the West. And dancing was just a lost art, even in Paris. And we think of it as being very French. In fact, all the terminology, as you know, is all French. It's battement tendu, it's French. But
the French words diffused all over the place and then were kind of lost in France, but they were
using the French lingo in Russia. The great teacher in Russia was Cecchetti, who was, in fact, Italian. So this it was brought from France. in the 19th century, but then it was totally lost in France as an art form.
Isn't that amazing?
That's yes.
Who knew this? When you think about French ballet today, it's world class.
Of course.
So what was the audience? Who was participating? Who was watching this? Who was supporting it? What was the whole social scene like around dance when Diaghilev went to Western Europe?
Well, he didn't have an audience. The audience, he created the audience. He created the audience because of the extraordinary work that he did, because it was society, and you have to remember we were coming out of, although it was France, we were coming out of the Victorian era in terms of our sensibilities. Visually, we were coming out of Impressionism and Post-Impressionism. Cubism hadn't happened yet, or the first vestiges of it were about to happen or just happening. So the audiences were interesting to see what this man was bringing them. And I back up and talk about the first three works he did in 1909, but I really talk about Firebird, because with it he changed everything, because for the first time he collaborated. He worked with Fokine, the choreographer, with Golovin, the designer, and Stravinsky, the composer, to form a new way of doing ballet. And so as soon as people saw that, they said, oh my God, this is amazing. But the next thing that happened is he brought and in fact, part of the beauty of Firebird is there is an exoticism to that. And he brought it another step forward from there to eroticism, which, believe it or not, Parisians had never seen him. And so when he brought Scheherazade with the bacchanals and everybody on carpets and on these divans and all of this, it changed everything. It literally changed the design, changed interior design, costume design, changed haute couturier. I mean, it all changed because everybody wanted to have a bacchanal. I mean, that's what they wanted. And so it changed interior design, it changed architecture, it changed all of those things. You have to remember that Debussy had just recently, in the late 19th century, heard the instrument called the celeste, which was brought from the East. All these exotic sounds, it was all fomenting at the same time.
What is that instrument?
It's kind of like a glockenspiel that you play with a keyboard. You know, and we most know it in dance now, because in the Nutcracker from Petipa's time, it was introduced, and it is the da da dum 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 da da dum da da dum da da dum 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 da da dum, which is the dance of the sugar plum fairy. Right.
And when something is so new, there are always kind of opposite reactions. So people take it on, and then people rebel against it.
Well, the biggest of those rebellions I go into in great length happened in 1913, because that was the premiere of Le Sacre du Printemps, The Rite of Spring. And I've taken an excerpt from a film and added it to my program, because it's from a film called Coco Chanel and Igor Stravinsky, which is a wonderful film which really talks about their relationship and his affair with Chanel, and even his family living in Chanel's home, but that's another story. The premiere provoked outrage of the Rite of Spring, so much so that the choreographer Nijinsky, the great dancer, was screaming dancers' counts in the wings, because the dancers couldn't hear the 110-member orchestra over the row that was happening in the theater. And it's depicted in this film brilliantly, where they're saying, outrage, outrage. Of course, it's all in French, and they have subtitles telling me that they're saying outrage and go back to Russia and all of that. But there was a fist fight in that theater. And in fact, that's something else that Diaghilev did. He loved to court scandal. He loved it.
Why?
Because it produced, put panties in seats is what it did.
Right, as in there's no such thing as bad publicity.
There's no such thing. He P.T. Barnum before P.T. Barnum thought of that.
As you talk about all this music, why don't we listen to some of it? What shall we, do you want to play something from The Rite of Spring right now?
Yes, I think the sacrificial dance speaks to it, because that's the moment at which the audience had in the early portion of the ballet, they were just mystified about what this was all about. But when they heard this primal music, they reacted violently in the audience, yes.
Let's hear that right now, and we'll be right back. And we've been listening to a clip from Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky, which provoked fist fights and mayhem. And it's such a great example of how our ear changes over a couple of generations. It doesn't really take that long. It's almost hard to imagine this provoking fist fights.
Well, actually, even more so than Le Sacre, the Firebird provoked an interesting reaction by one of the dancers, because when it was choreographed and devised by Fokine, Golovin, and Stravinsky, with the aid and abetting of Diaghilev, the title role was offered to by Fokine to the great Pavlova. And Anna Pavlova turned down the Firebird because she said she would not dance to Stravinsky's ugly music.
Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. So very, that was the beginning of it.
Now, Rite of Spring, the choreography has not survived, and still photographs have survived. And I saw somebody tried to recreate it from the photographs, and the dance, unfortunately, it looked like a series of stills in a funny way. It's very hard to do. But do we have, how do you put yourself back in the position of seeing that piece of ballet?
Well, I think if you see an awful lot of the stills and you understand the whole premise of what Nijinsky did, he, instead of everything being uplifted, they danced into the floor. There was no turnout. They, in fact, turned their feet in and they pounded the floor. So it was so completely different. Actually, again, that film Coco Chanel and Igor Stravinsky represents it really quite well. And there have been recreations. Most notably, Robert Joffrey first did them. He's recreated a lot of the Ballet Russe works, including Sacre. It's been recreated in Paris. So I think we've learned enough and gleaned enough from the stills that we can figure out what, in fact, that might have looked like.
Right. We're talking to Tom McGuire about his presentation, which is going to be happening tomorrow at Collected Works Bookstore, Barbarians at the Gate, Stravinsky, Diaghilev, and the Ballet Russe. Now, why do you call it Barbarians at the Gate?
You know, I was just asked that just a day ago by a friend of mine who is, in fact, a lighting designer and used to travel with American Ballet Theatre for years. He said, why did you use that? Because actually I used that term, I think, before the Tom Wolfe, any of that. I take pride in that. Because they were considered to be barbarians at the gate by the people who walked out of Sacre that evening. And some people did not resonate it with at all. But he knew, Diaghilev knew intuitively, that the outrage that he created for some people was excitement for others. So I thought of it in those terms, that it was this excitement that was right there in front of you, and you just had to have the courage to let the barbarians in.
It's interesting because, of course, he was rejected very much in Russia after the Russian Revolution and by the new communist Soviet government, which saw him and his whole world as incredibly bourgeois decadence.
That's correct. That's correct. And in fact, the one really incredibly sad story is that he didn't know until, well, actually, he didn't know in his lifetime. We didn't know until quite recently that his brother was killed during the revolution. Not the revolution itself, but died in the gulags. And so he was demonized in Russia. But as you say, they were saying he was bourgeois, and yet he was everything not bourgeois.
Yeah, I mean, the bourgeois were the ones who were telling him that he was
yes.
anything but,
that's
but them. It's it's interesting. So you've got Stravinsky, Nijinsky, Diaghilev, these Russians making a huge impact in Europe. What did they bring? I mean, it seems like it was a very intensive Russian period. Was it their being in exile? Or?
Well, it really was a kind of art, and I say art because it was, again, visual arts, and nobody had ever heard anything like Boris, for instance. Boris Godunov, that was so, I mean, that's, you know, understand that's the difference between the East and the West, you know, and that's why the exoticism of Scheherazade and all of that seems so intriguing to them. Russia had been isolated in some ways under the Tsars, truly isolated. It was very insular, a wonderful point in time in Tsarist Russia, but it was isolated from the West in so many ways. So they brought that. And it was the new, and, you know, in the early 20th century, it was time for the new, no matter what the new was. In fact, that's one of the things that I point up about Diaghilev. I say that, you know, paraphrasing Will Rogers, he never met an ism he didn't like, because he, you know, whether it was, you know, cubism or whatever the ism was, he would jump into it with both feet and just screaming, this is the new way. You know, I actually look at it sometimes and I look at the material and think, was this really great ballet? It may not have been in a lot of cases. It was great dance theater, and it was great theater, and it was great spectacle in a lot of ways. And that's what they brought. They had never seen things like that.
And great collaboration.
Yes.
I mean, when you allow equality among the different art forms, that's an art in itself.
That's correct. And it became so identified with the Russian ballet that I will tell you a side story that I always talk about. I'm giving half of it away here. Everybody had to be Russian. And in fact, you were given a Russian name if you didn't choose one, if you weren't in fact Russian.
What do you mean? If you were a member of the ballet company? Or?
That's correct. So the great dancer, Alisha Markova, or Markova if you wish that way, that is a woman by the name of Alice Marks. She was a British woman. And the one who lived here, Vera Zarina, who died years ago, about maybe 89 years, maybe 10 years ago, Vera Zarina chose that name. She was Brigitte Hartwig, one of Balanchine's wives, actually. And she chose that name because it was the last one on the list. So everyone had to be Russian.
Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing.
And that was Diaghilev's mandate?
Absolutely, because how could we have a Russian ballet if you are a British woman?
So we make you a fake Russian.
Make you a fake Russian.
We're talking to Tom McGuire. So let's talk for a moment about exoticism. Here's one of your isms. People know intuitively maybe or have an idea what that means, but what does it really mean?
I think that always refers to something being different than what you're used to. And so for people in Paris at that time, when you understand they were just coming out of bustles, you know, and all of a sudden people were roaming around the stage in very scant costumes, very revealing costumes. The colors were just ravishing, but they weren't ravishing the way I see Impressionism or Post-Impressionism. There's a softness to that. These were right in your face, a Gorky, you know. I mean, we're talking that kind, it's that kind of, that kind of in-your-face color. And they had never seen it quite like that. A mixture of colors in some ways. I mean, when you think of it, a Monet or anybody from that period of time, they have a softness to the colors.
I wonder if exoticism doesn't also imply a kind of erotic or bodily freedom in some ways.
Absolutely, that was part of it. I mean, that's where I see it as more dance spectacle, for instance, let's say Scheherazade, than pure ballet, because you can't see, okay, this is about Montandu, and these are beats, this is, you know, I'm landing in fifth position. No, it was just bodies moving in ways nobody had seen before, except maybe some of the modern dancers that came from America.
Let's talk about Stravinsky. Tell us a little bit about his life and how he and Diaghilev came together.
Well, he was a student of Rimsky-Korsakov, and so his training was brilliant. And he was
already... Was Diaghilev also a student of Rimsky-Korsakov? Briefly?
Sort of, except that Rimsky-Korsakov said he has absolutely no talent.
Right.
Yes, yes. So you know,
which may or may not have been true, but it changed the course of his life.
It changed the course of his life. And in fact, he referred to himself as a man with no talent, but lots of taste. Stravinsky came forward and was writing wonderful, interesting music. And I think it was the fact that in the collaboration, Diaghilev said, you know, basically, go for it. Let me see what you want to do. So he wasn't constraining him, because 19th century in ballet, it began with the choreographer saying, oh, I need 64 measures or 128 dancers counts of a march. And that's the way a Tchaikovsky or a Borodin would write. They would write on command for that, as opposed to Stravinsky saying, what's the feeling you're trying to convey here? And I will try to convey that feeling. And then his was an interesting arc. Some people would say that at some point, after a few of these major Russian works, the great Russian works, the joke was that he had lost his Russian folk music book. Because what happened is he went in a different direction. He began writing what then they called his neoclassic style. And everything from Pulcinella on was in that style. So that was an interesting arc. He took this outrageous arc in Russian derived music, and then it flattened out, and I say that very respectfully, into this broad understanding of classicism, and that's where Apollo came from, and that's where all of the later works. You understand, there was the longer relationship between Stravinsky and Balanchine later. That
right.
went on for years and years and years. So from Apollo on, they worked until Stravinsky's death, and then, of course, Balanchine continued using works by Stravinsky after Stravinsky died until his death.
Should we hear some music by Stravinsky now?
Oh, I would love to hear Stravinsky. Let's do something from Firebird. Maybe the Dance of the Firebird will give you a little bit of that.
Excellent. So, music from The Firebird by Igor Stravinsky. Just been listening to a piece from The Firebird by Igor Stravinsky.
Well, you know, I have to remind you that I earlier told you that Pavlova refused to dance to this ugly music. Now, by my standards, that's not ugly music.
But again, you put yourself, you try to put yourself, it's not always easy to put yourself into the position of being an audience 100 or more years ago.
Sure.
I was once watching, just as an aside, the Martha Graham Dance Company, after Martha Graham died, came to Santa Fe in somewhere in the early 90s, I think it was, and I was watching it, and I was bored to tears. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to pretend that it's 1947.
That's correct.
And I just put myself in the headspace of it's 1947, and suddenly it came to life.
That's correct. I remember those performances. Actually, weren't they in Los Alamos?
I saw it at the College of Santa Fe.
Oh, College of Santa Fe. They did performances up in Los Alamos, and amongst them they did Appalachian Spring. So
right.
It was startling to see it that way.
Yeah.
Do you know one of the other directions that the Ballet Russe went was the work that really began a separation between Diaghilev and his male dancer and his protege, his lover, Nijinsky, because it was the work entitled La Première d'un Faune, The Afternoon of a Faun, that was to startle the audiences, perhaps even a little bit more than Sacre did. And La
Sacre being the Rite of Spring.
The Rite of Spring. So Afternoon of a Faun was equally startling, because in some ways Nijinsky was a modern dancer, because Sacre, he made them turn in and stomp the floor.
Turn in meaning turning
their
feet toward each other,
yes,
instead of turning out in
that's
the
correct
ballet way.
Yes, instead of the ballet way. Turning their feet in and stomping the floor. In La Prenedi, he made them look like the friezes on Greek vases. They were two-dimensional. And as you said, you saw that work at one point with Baryshnikov.
Yeah, and that was one of the memorable moments of my whole entire life.
Absolutely. And who was he dancing with?
Darcy Kistler, who at that point was brand new. She was 19. That dates me, but she became one of the great dancers of the New York City Ballet in the kind of Balanchine, post-Balanchine era.
Sure. Well, he put them in two-dimensionally. I mean, they were in a bas-relief, really, is what they were. They were moving bas-reliefs. And the score for that, of course, is extraordinary. And that's the Debussy work. It's a tone poem. It's based on the poem by Stéphane Mallarmé.
Well, I think we should hear that, too.
Absolutely. Let's do a little of that.
Okay. Prelude to The Afternoon of a Faun by Claude Debussy. And we've just been listening to Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun by Claude Debussy. We're talking to Tom McGuire, talking about his upcoming presentation. He'll be speaking tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore in a presentation titled Barbarians at the Gate, Stravinsky, Diaghilev, and the Ballet Russe. Now, you're a musician. How did you get so passionately interested in ballet?
Well, when I was at conservatory, I began working on some Stravinsky scores, either playing them or just studying them, and I became fascinated with his music. And then I started reading books on Stravinsky. In fact, at one point I had read everything in the New York City Public Library on Stravinsky. That'll tell you how long ago, because now books on Stravinsky probably take up 3 or 4 shelves. But in doing so, I kept seeing this name Diaghilev, and I kept seeing the Ballet Russe. And that happened also at the same time I started doing a lot of work in New York, and I began playing for ballet. And I played under Robert Irving at New York City Ballet, both at City Center before they moved to Lincoln Center, and at Lincoln Center at what that was called the New York State Theater. And that was the beginning of my real love affair for dance and ballet specifically. And then over the years, I played for Harkness and Joffrey and Houston and Dallas and San Francisco and Ballet West. And it just became a passion of mine. So I was in the pit a lot, both as a player, as a percussion player in the pit, or in fact sometimes as a conductor in the pit. I said to you before we began today, if I never see another Nutcracker or perform another one, because I'm somewhere north of about 350, 360 performances of that work, as brilliant as it is. And also, my daughter became a dancer and spent a lot of time in a career from age 15 to age 32. And, that was her career, was as a dancer, and now she works for a dance department at a university.
Teaching dance.
No, of course. What happens to all dancers? They end up teaching Pilates, right?
Oh, no.
And old dancers never die. They just teach Pilates, you know.
Well, they didn't even have Pilates when I was a kid studying ballet.
I know. Well, now she teaches
this. It's probably better for them. Their bodies got ruined. I don't know if they still do. Do dancers' bodies still get ruined?
Yes. That still happens. She teaches as many athletes as she does dancers.
Now, what was it like for you as a pit musician doing ballet, and particularly as a percussionist? I mean, it's not like the violin where you're busy all the time. What instruments did you play?
Anything that was a percussion instrument. So that meant a lot of time where you weren't playing.
You weren't playing the conga drums, right?
No. But, everything from cymbals to bass drum to gongs to snare drum to tambourines. And, there's so much that you play. But the beauty of it is if I stood very tall, a lot of pits, I could see into, at least halfway upstage and see the dancers. So often I would do that. If I were off for a complete ballet, I might go out of the pit, go around to the front of the house, and watch that ballet. In fact, I always tell a story about Robert Joffrey. I was playing, and I loved to see his work. So I was playing in the pit, and every time I had a moment, I'd run out, run around the theater, go in the back, back of the house, and watch the next piece. And I really wanted to see Green Tables, which is one of the great works of the 20th century, Kurt Jost. And so I'm in the back of the theater, and I am watching, and I'm so enthralled by what I'm seeing, and I'm hearing a voice behind me, and the voice is talking, and it's sotto voce, but it's bothering me. And I turn around ready to rip somebody's head off because I hear them talking, and it's Bob Joffrey. Because he's standing there, and he's got an assistant who's taking notes. Now, the importance of this is not that he was bothering me. This was the last day of the run. It was also the last day of a 6-week tour. It was also the last day before these dancers were on a break for almost 8 weeks before they would assemble in New York again and continue on with rehearsals and performances. And here was Bob Joffrey, ready to give notes to these dancers at the end of this performance.
Even though they weren't going to do it again anytime soon.
Anytime soon. And that told you about the brilliance of Bob Joffrey, and it was also the reason I didn't rip his head off.
We're talking to Tom McGuire. So We've been talking about Diaghilev and Stravinsky and the Ballet Russe and this incredible time. And when you think about, it wasn't really that long, these 20 years, 1909 to 1929, but historically so much happened. A world war, the Russian Revolution, and so on.
That's right.
And what happened after he died, after Diaghilev died in 1929, in terms of the continuing of ballet in that time and place?
Well, that's actually probably the subject of maybe in my next life I will do that piece. There's been a wonderful book written just recently by Judith Benaham, who is a professor emeritus of dance history at UNM, and she writes about the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo and René Blum. And what happened really is after Diaghilev died, it was a shambles because nobody had any work. And they were on a hiatus for the summer.
And nobody could take over.
And that was the big question. What would happen next? These dancers had no work and no income and in a lot of cases no food, you know. They were starving artists even in the best of times. So it was a circumstance where what would happen next? I think, as much as anything, whoever could get the costumes and sets out of Hawk and out of the warehouse and could assemble a bunch of dancers and work with one of the choreographers that had been with the company, they would go ahead and proceed and mount a company. And what happened is two companies emerged. One under Colonel Bazile, who had been doing a lot of managing for Diaghilev, and another under René Blum. And it became, at one point, they're referred to as the Ballet Wars. At one point, Sol Hurok, the great promoter from the United States, was touring two Ballet Russe companies around the United States. Not unlike a few years ago, as a dance lover, you might remember late 80s, early 90s, when there were two Bolshois traveling around the United States.
No, I don't remember that. Two Bolshois?
There were two Bolshois, and at that time it was different, because it really was whoever could put together something in Russia with dancers who were not working at the time, so that also told you what kind of quality they might have, and they would go out and do standard repertoire, and they would. It was almost like the when I was in the pits for other kinds of things, it was almost like when you had the red and the blue core of people who went on the ice shows. There were two ice capades at any one time. So there were two Bolshois. But back in the Ballet Russe time, it was a real competition for dancers and for choreographers. So Massine went one direction, and then other people went other directions. Lefar went another direction. So those companies separated out, and the most survivable, if you will, company was the Ballet Russe, and it ended in the 14th of April of 1962, so it lasted that long.
Wow, very interesting. In terms of the spirit and the collaborative artistry, you know, the visual, the music, and the dance all having tremendous strength and almost equality in some of these dances that Diaghilev put together, who do you think are the heirs? I mean, who's the next generation that has continued that spirit, if anyone?
I believe it was Balanchine.
George Balanchine.
Yeah, I think it was Balanchine, because what I didn't say about these other Ballet Russe companies, Balanchine soon separated himself and didn't want to do that. As he said in a letter that I've seen at Harvard, he wanted to create new ballets with new names and didn't want to continue as the Ballet Russe. And in fact, if you really look at it carefully, the Ballet Russe companies that came after Diaghilev's death began with just doing the same works. They did the pieces that were developed under Diaghilev, and in fact they became quite threadbare. The only real change was when Massine was forced to create an entire season of works overnight, because he was denied his own works from his time with Colonel Bazile's company. So that new work came on. But before that, Gaieté Parisienne, some other pieces, before that, they were just recycling. Freddie Franklin tells a wonderful story that it got so bad that when he would leap onto the pillows in Scheherazade, the cloud of dust that would go up every time would make the audience laugh. So they were recycling.
I mean, that is truly a sign of a tired old.
The tired old piece, but Balanchine went on, and it was always something new. When I was in conservatory, we were lucky enough we would get tickets that people turned back in, and I would go, and I could see two or three brand new works by Stravinsky in one evening. Balanchine, Stravinsky works in one evening. So in a way, that was very collaborative.
Now, he died in 1983. What about since then?
I think Christopher Wheeldon is doing great work, but none of it has been as collaborative as way back when.
Right.
More the modern dancers, and that is not my field, and I don't know it as well.
Right.
I think Twyla worked that way a lot. Yeah, but amongst the ballet dancers and the ballet choreographers, there's a little bit of that buying the music by the yard kind of thing, and I'll take some of this and put a pastiche together.
Tom McGuire, your presentation tomorrow night is called Barbarians at the Gate, Stravinsky, Diaghilev, and the Ballet Russe. What is the nature of this presentation, or what are we going to see and hear besides you talking?
Yes, and that's, you know, you have to get past that, don't you?
No, it's good, but...
The genesis of this has been my collection of materials. I have collected materials, mostly ephemera, photographs, costume designs. I have costume designs by Lien Box, which is my great love, is that work. I'm an eBay junkie. I'm now in competition with somebody with far more money than I have. So
on eBay, you're all bidding for the same things?
Yes, and I'm losing out, even though I'm using a Snipe program, if you know what those are.
Yeah,
They bid in milliseconds in the last three seconds.
I have been out-sniped until I figured out how to out-snipe the snipers,
You must tell me some more tricks. But I've been collecting materials, and it's a pretty vast collection. The book collection, and just ballet, it's not modern dance. The book collection is somewhere north of about 250 books. And in fact, I'm looking for the right institution to give it to at some point, when I'm horizontal, and go out of this place in a box. But, you know, I'm looking for the opportunity to place that material.
When you go to the ballet theater in
the
sky.
That's right. No, unfortunately, it'll be in the pit in the sky. You know, I always said that my career, if I would ever write a book, would be called Hours of Boredom, Moments of Terror, because as a percussion player, you sit in the pit for hours, and then all of a sudden you have to make a lot of noise and sit back down again.
Yeah, it sounds kind of like being a cop.
Yes. So I've been collecting this material, and then I started, you know, I had read so much material, and I was asked to do something for the Chamber Music Festival quite a few years ago. And it seemed to be successful, and I thought I'm enough of a marketing person in my own mind to say this is something I could do more often. And I've prepared this now for college and university dance departments. That's one venue.
So we'll see some of the costume designs.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, since there aren't any really recorded materials like videos, obviously, or even film from Firebird, I illustrate a musical segment with costume designs and some stills from that period of time. And for instance, there is a wonderful series of photographs that were done for Afternoon of a Faun, and that's the only thing you see during the playing of a segment of Afternoon of a Faun. So it's all based on my collection.
So we will see you, Tom McGuire, tomorrow night. Tom McGuire is a musician, conductor, and arts administrator, and as you have heard, ladies and gentlemen, a great lover and supporter of dance, particularly ballet. The presentation is called Barbarians at the Gate, Stravinsky, Diaghilev, and the Ballet Russe at Collected Works Bookstore right here in Santa Fe on Galisteo Street on the corner of Water. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
And shall we go out with just a little more music?
Okay.
We're going to hear a bit of the finale from Igor Stravinsky's Firebird.